Welcome back to Shattering Myths. It's our time to turn to Yael. We're going to use evidence and reason to get to know him, to get to understand more completely what he has said to us, what he is offering us, what he expects from us, so that those of you who are serious about coming to know God will have that opportunity. Those of you who are serious about forming a relationship with him will know how to do it. We also have Larry now joining us, calling in from Florida. Good morning, Larry. How are you today?
Good morning. Got a question for you here.
Sure, sure.
What would you make theologian from Notre Dame? Okay. Yeah.
So he's got two strikes against him already. Theologian. So he's a part of the perpetrator of a religious myth.
Yeah. Right.
And Notre Dame, which is the seat of Roman Catholicism here in America.
Yeah. Right. Where I see a posting that says it says here that. Habakkuk in Genesis 15:6 prove that Paul turned as what he proclaimed to be faith was the way to become right with God, not performing deeds of the law, and that Paul understood the word faith to mean trustful reliance and promises, you know, on the promises given to Abraham. Now, what kind of nonsense, what kind of hoop jumping would one have to go to get to that point? I ask this because in my group I had a person posted. I ended up booting them. I say, you know, he's been in the group 6 months and he calls himself Truth Seeker. Well, if you haven't found any truth in Yahweh's words within 6 months, when it's laid out in front of you, chances are you're certainly not going to find truth chasing the tail of some theologian who pretends to be an expert, not on Yahweh's words, but on the Qumran community. First of all, I don't believe that the Qumran community was righteous. Where I look at the DSS and say that it's worth reading is, is that they didn't have the rabbis purposely corrupting it 1,100 years later.
So what the theologian is saying, this theologian is an expert on the Qumran scrolls, is that correct?
Yeah, that's his claim. Not on the scrolls, on the community.
Okay, because it's interesting, of course, with hypocrisy, because the Roman Catholic Church, working with the Muslims, were given control over those scrolls because they were found in what is considered to be the West Bank. And so the Muslims who controlled the West Bank, they were part of Jordan at the time. This was they were found in 1955, and that is before the Six-Day War. So in the West Bank, they were part of Jordan. They were turned over to Jordan, and the team that was given the authority to publish them was comprised of Roman Catholics who were almost always anti-Semitic. The whole story of the Dead Sea Scrolls is one of the saddest stories in human history in terms of how most of them have not even been published to this day, and that a significant aspect of the problem was a combination of the Muslims forbidding any Jew to work on the scrolls, even though they were their scrolls. And second, the Roman Catholic Church having authority over the entire group and them being extraordinarily anti-Semitic and not wanting the evidence of those scrolls released to the world. And so it really was a bit of reverse engineering that caused many of the scrolls to be released and people doing what needed to be done, people going around the Roman Catholic Church to get the data in the scrolls released. Now, as it relates to why he would cite Habakkuk and faith, is that there is the word that God uses in Habakkuk 2 does not actually mean faith. It means trust and reliance. But the reason that that this theologian is saying that Paul understood it and made the connection to the Qumran community is that Habakkuk is one of the scrolls that is memorialized in the Qumran archives. They have parts of every book of the Torah, prophets, and Psalms, except Esther, I think, which is the one that doesn't cite Yahweh's name. And because it doesn't have Yahweh's name in it, it can be burned. The books that have Yahweh's name, according to rabbinic tradition, cannot be burned, and therefore they must be buried, and that's why we found the scrolls in Qumran. Now, the Habakkuk is an interesting prophecy, and what's so fascinating by it is that it is the most adroit prediction Yahweh, God, ever made regarding a religious leader. It was regarding Shaul. Yeah. And Shaul is a extraordinarily evil man. God speaks of him as being the plague of death. Now, Shaul actually quoted the out of the prophecy regarding him twice. Once in Galatians, and the I think it's Galatians 3, like 17 something in that, but I'll find it here exactly for you. And the other is in Romans 1:17. So Paul was so fascinated by this. It's kind of like the daredevil who just can't resist the death-defying act. Well, Paul knew that that Habakkuk 2 was about him. It names him specifically. It gives some 15 to 20 very specific insights into Paul's attitude, his style, his approach, who his audience was going to be, what he was what he was going to do. And at the and in the midst of it, God actually says, and his name is Shaul. Shaul is the actual birth name of the man who chose to adopt the Roman name Apollos, but his Hebrew name is Shaul. And in that, what Paul is doing in Galatians and again in Romans is he's trying to bypass the Torah by saying that Abraham didn't have the Torah, and so it wasn't the Torah that made him righteous. It wasn't even the covenant and the terms and conditions of the covenant that made him righteous. What made Abraham righteous was faith. He had faith in God. Now,
which is nonsense.
Well, first of all, every bit of that is nonsense. First of all, the Yahweh specifically tells us in the Torah, which is the only place where Abraham is even known to us, that he gave Abraham his Torah, that he taught Abraham his Torah.
Absolutely.
So the first part of that is rendered senseless just because that's what God says. Second is, how can you use a story that is only known to us in the Torah to discredit the Torah?
You can't.
Okay. And now then the third is that the difference between Abraham and this theologian is that the Abraham actually got to know God. God introduced himself to him, asked him to leave Babylon, met with him again when he arrived in the Promised Land in Israel, walked with him, ate with him, talked with him, drank with him.
Established a covenant with him.
Right. Made promises to him, honored the promises he made to them. They became very close. It would be like me saying that rather than knowing my son, I believe that I have a relationship with my son. I mean, I know him.
I
wouldn't say I believe I have a son. I know I have one. I talk to him. We've done lots of things together. Abraham did not have faith in Yahweh. He knew him. And so the whole argument that Paul is making is flawed at the get-go. A, you can't use the Torah to discredit the Torah, and that's the only place that Abraham is even known to us. B, the Abraham, Yahweh tells us explicitly in that same story that he gave his Torah teaching to Abraham. See, the entire relationship with Abraham is dependent upon Abraham accepting the terms and conditions of the covenant and responding to them. And they had a personal, ongoing relationship where Yahweh intervened in his life, talked with him, made promises to him, and honored those promises. So what Paul does is he then takes snippets of testimony, typically from the Torah. This particular one was not. It was from Habakkuk, and he quotes it, takes the verse out of context, misquotes it to convey a myth. And so the theologian is saying that Paul understands the role the role faith plays by quoting Habakkuk. That's not what the Habakkuk passage says. It says, first, God says, I have laid down my my requirements. I've told you what they are, and I'm not changing. I'm going to stick to my requirements. I've taken a stand on these things. I'm not going to change. And then he says, it's through trust and reliance on these things that there is salvation. So trust and reliance on that which can be known, that which I have said, that which is dependable, is the source of your salvation. And of course, from the satanic viewpoint, well, you just remove a snippet of that from its context. You replace trust and reliance with faith. You ignore everything that can be known. And you can create this mythology that a relationship with God and salvation is faith-based as opposed to...
From this posting, he ends it. It's a good read and very informative. Now, this from a guy who is an interpreter of the Qumran scrolls and an expert of the community. Yet he uses terms like faith, titles right. like Lord, names like Jesus. And at the same time, he says, I tried to convey this a few weeks ago under the impression the Qumran community knew more about Scripture than anyone alive today. First of all, I don't know that the Qumrans, it seems to me that Yahweh walked away from Yisrael and Judah many years prior to Qumran.
The fact of the matter is that the Qumran, if you look at the Qumran scrolls, the minority of the Qumran scrolls are actually scriptural. Now, there's lots of fragments from many of the books, but most of the Qumran scrolls are economic documents. They're just they're normal business lives. And the second largest set of scrolls are about the battles between the righteous one and I forgot what the term is for the enemy, but you go back to the Maccabean revolt. They have this whole, the righteous one and the unrighteous one. We'll be back in a moment. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. I'm your host, Yada. We're here with Larry. He brought up a question about a Roman Catholic theologian who is writing that that based upon his interpretation of the scrolls of the Qumran community, that Paul understood the role that faith plays in one's salvation, and that this can be determined by his citations of Habakkuk. And it's true that Paul did quote Habakkuk from the second chapter twice. And what it actually proves is the grave consequence that's associated with telling a half-truth as opposed to the whole truth, of the consequence of removing something from its context. While we were during the break, this is a great example of this in the world of Islam. Israel was accused of shooting a young boy, Muhammad al-Dura, during the 1970 Intifada, the Islamic uprising amongst the Palestinians. There was a gun battle between the Islamic jihadists leading this intifada, which is the uprising of Muslims against Israel. And there's a 12-year-old boy that was allegedly shot and killed in the crossfire. And the French media made this the cause célèbre, the number one kind of overriding image of this uprising of the Palestinians. The poor Palestinians, they're you know, being oppressed. Their lands are being occupied. Those terrible Jews, they're killing their children. And that was the news story. And there's images, news reports to convey this. And you say, now what in the world is he doing talking about this story when the story is taking something out of context and not telling the whole story, being misleading? Well, the Israelis were finally given access to the film, and they conducted a thorough investigation. And what their investigation initially showed, that there's absolutely no indication of who shot the boy, that or if the boy was even shot, because of the fact that it was a crossfire. They were just sitting in the crossfire between the Islamic militants who had decided that that killing Jews was going to be a good religious sport. You know, it's like an American might say, let's go out and go deer hunting today. The Muslims got up one day and said, let's go off and hunt some Jews.
Oh, yeah.
Well, the reality is that there's actually no indication the boy was even killed. Because the report that the French media put out on this shows doesn't show the end of the footage of the that they captured. At the end of the tape, which is the part they didn't air, the boy's walking around. He's just fine. He is just fine. It's kind of like those funerals where they're all wailing and telling the terrible Jews, and they've got the caskets above their heads, and the Jews, they killed our baby boy, and then the part that doesn't make the headline news at 11 has the boy set up in the coffin at the end of the tape.
They call that Hollywood.
Oh, and get out of it. So, you know, when you show. So when you only reveal part of something, what you're doing is trying to usurp credibility and mislead people. And this is the nature of all religions. The way that Satan works is he takes what God has said out of context, misquotes him to create the impression that the opposite of what God has said is true. And that's the problem when you remove a conversation from its context. In particular, turning to Habakkuk 2. I'm going to share it with you now because when you actually read what Paul stole from context to twist God's testimony, what you find is God telling us, you know, I am not going to change. This notion that Paul says that he has my authority to change everything and to move away from the requirements that I've established and that I myself have stood upon is not only untrue, but it's the plague of death. Listen to what God has to say. He begins, this is Habakkuk 2. Upon my requirements, on my responsibilities and obligations, my mission, I have decided I will literally and continually stand, Ahmad. I will always be present. So as it relates to the requirements to participate in the covenant relationship with him, the requirements associated with our salvation, and God's responsibilities and obligations unto those things, which God not only talked the talk, he walked the walk. He was there with us when he took us historically away from religion and politics, out of Egypt and into the promised land. And he's the one that fulfilled Pesach, Matzah, and Bukurim, as well as Shavuah, actually taking his stand based upon his responsibilities and obligations in this relationship. So God says,
can I go a little further there?
Sure.
Because of the next verse, he says, and I'll choose to always stand and present myself upon that which protects and fortifies, so I'll be on the lookout in order to see what he has to say about me.
Yeah, we'll return to that thought when Shattering Mist returns after the commercial break. It is insightful indeed when we read God's testimony in context. Welcome back to Shattering Mist. We're having a discussion with Larry, who brought to our attention a Roman Catholic theologian trying to exonerate Paul and citing a passage that actually condemns Paul. And it proves what happens, demonstrates what happens when you take something out of context and twist it. In this particular case, Paul twice, once in Romans, the other time is in Galatians, quotes a snippet from Habakkuk 2, to prove, demonstrate, if you will, that faith is the basis of salvation. It's not what God says. And when you actually read what God says, rather than believe Paul, you will run from him. So this begins by saying, upon my requirements, I have decided I will literally and continually stand. And as Larry said, it goes on to say, and I will choose to always stand and present myself upon that which fortifies and protects. So I will be on the lookout in order to see what he will say about me. So God has framed the issue.
Sheol.
Yeah, now you don't know that at this point, but you will if you read further down. And we're going to. But God has framed the issue. Framing the issue is essential to understanding. What is the issue? God's saying, I'm not going to change. God is saying, I have established requirements. I have my personal responsibilities under these requirements. I myself have to fulfill Passover and unleavened bread and first fruits and Shavuah. And I'm going to personally fulfill Yom Kippurim and the Day of Reconciliations, as well as Sukkah shelters. I have my responsibilities. I've made five promises relative to the covenant, and I'm going to deliver. God's saying, I'm not going to change. I am dependable, and I am personally going to take my stand so that faith is unrequired. I'm going to do it myself. You can depend on me. So, recognizing this, is there somebody that's going to come along? God is saying there is somebody that's going to come along and try to renounce all that. And it's going to say, hey, God is changing, and I've been authorized to report to you God's reneging on his previous stand. That all of his previous requirements are being done away with. And here's this guy saying, yep, God's authorized me to tell you that he's changed everything. And God is saying, well, let's wait and see what this fellow has to say about me. Then God says, then how can I be expected to change my attitude, my thinking, or my response concerning my disapproving rebuke? So if this individual who says that God is going to change, to renege on all of his previous requirements, to walk away from the things that he's taken a stand on, God is saying, so why would anybody think that I am not going to strongly disapprove against this individual? Why would anybody in their right mind think I'm going to change? I went to such effort, personal sacrifice to enable this plan. What on earth would cause any rational person to think I'm going to change? And they think that I'm smart enough to have created the universe. I'm loving enough to have created the covenant. I'm articulate enough to have authored the Torah. And I'm compassionate enough to myself, diminishing myself, getting on my knees to lift you up by fulfilling my promises. And yet, in spite of all that, they're going to say that I was so inept, so impotent, that I'm just going to give up and say, you know, that was all for naught. I guess I was just kidding myself. I am an incompetent boob. What I need is this guy to come and correct everything and start over with a whole new plan because I'm obviously an incompetent boob.
What do you think the odds of that are?
Zero. Then Yahweh answered, approaching me, speaking now to Habakkuk. And he said, write this revelation. And then expound and reiterate it using those letters upon writing tablets so that by reciting this, he might run. And so what God is telling us here is that well, I'm going to communicate to you in writing because that's the medium that's going to be used here. I'm going to communicate to you in writing. I'm going to make this a permanent record because I've always communicated to you in writing. That's what I do. And if we recite this, then people might run away from this individual. Now, the reason that run here is interesting is that throughout Galatians, Paul announces that he's running a race, and the race that he's running is against Yahweh's disciples. He's in competition with them. And so he constantly speaks of running this race, and So therefore, God is saying, yeah, you know, guess who he's running from? He's running from me. And he'll run from you, too, if you cite what I am sharing with you. Still, indeed, God says, this revelation from God is for the appointed meeting time. It provides a witness and speaks in the end.
Now, so, the appointed meeting time would be when Yahusha actually fulfilled the Moed.
Right. Yahweh introduces the Moed, which is the word Laha Moed, the appointed meeting time. The first time he speaks of these is in the fourth day of creation. And he says that in the fourth day of creation, speaking of the fourth era, 4,000 year of human existence outside of the garden, that he's going to establish the Moed, and that the greater light is going to become visible to us as a sign on this fourth day in relationship to the Moed. And year 4,000 Yah, which is 33 CE in our pagan calendars, Yahweh, in the form of Yahusha, came and he fulfilled the first four Moed. Pesach, Matzah, Bukurim, and Shavuah. And so the time of the Moed is 33 CE. The place of the Moed is Jerusalem, the four most important days in human history.
And
that's the time of the Moed.
And that's going to be when this guy appears.
Guess what Shaul is doing according to his own testimony in year 4000 Yah, 33 CE?
He's going to rabbinic school in Jerusalem.
That is correct. Mm-hmm. So, this revelation, God is saying, that the person I'm speaking about that's going to try to claim my authorization to change everything that I have said I'm going to do and that are my requirements to engaging in a relationship with me and to be saved by me, he's going to arise. Now, this was written at 600 BCE. He's going to arise at the appointed meeting time, which is 33 CE. The extended period of time required for this question to be resolved shall not prove it false. In other words, God said, you know, a lot of time is going to go by. There's going to be 600 years that's going to go by. Don't let the amount of time go by from the time I'm making this promise to you to the time it's fulfilled. Think that, hey, well, you know, it's not going to happen. I'm telling you, it's going to happen in year 4000 Yah, 33 CE. The extended period of time shall not prove it to be false. Expect him in this regard. Expect him in this regard. In what regard? Expect him in regard to appearing at the appointed meeting times when Yahusha was in Jerusalem fulfilling the first four Moed, but also in regard to this person that said that God is changing all of his requirements. Expect him in this regard because he will absolutely come, neither being delayed nor lingering. Now God says, pay attention. Pay attention. He will be puffed up with false pride. There is no one ever that spoke for God that even approaches, not even in the same magnitude of Paul's arrogance. I mean, even if you don't know that Paul was a false prophet, it doesn't take 15 minutes of reading Paul's to recognize that his ego was off the charts. As a matter of fact, he even said that the only reason that his ego was even constrained some small little bit was because he was constantly prodded by Satan, kept under control by a goad by Satan, who demon-possessed him by his own admission. So pay attention. He will be puffed up with false pride. His soul is not right in him. It's not straightforward. In other words, he uses reasoning that is circuitous, and he wanders away, twisting and convoluting. So through now, this is the part that Paul quoted. So God is saying, pay attention. This guy is conceited, and he is not straightforward. He uses circular reasoning. So extraordinarily arrogant person using circular reasoning.
Do you remember what Shimon Peter said about Paul's letters?
Yeah, he uses circular reasoning. And that's the reason that his letters are so damning is that he uses circular reasoning. And it's obvious. But anyway, what God is saying here is, okay, I've now told you about this guy. And I've told you what he's going to do. So if you're reading this, here's the antidote. So that you are not killed along with him. So that you don't sacrifice your own soul because you've been misled and joined his religion, Christianity. Here's the antidote. So through trust and reliance, va emunah, by being firmly established, confirmed, and upheld by that which is dependable and steadfast, always truthful and reliable, are those who are upright and vindicated, and they shall live. So God is saying, he began this by saying, upon my requirements, I'm going to take a stand. I am not going to change. Now, if you take this statement in Habakkuk 2:4 away from 2:1, then you wouldn't know what this trust and reliance was upon. But God introduced it in the first statement of this discussion, which is, upon my requirements, on my obligations, I'm going to take my stand. I'm not going to change. And so here he's saying, so trust and rely on those things. And so through trust and reliance, those who are upright and vindicated, they shall live. Now, what Paul changed that to is through faith, the vindicated shall live.
And then that becomes a religious notion, and faith is directly derived from Fidus, the Roman goddess of loyalty.
Right. But emunah doesn't mean faith.
Nope.
It means trust and reliance, and God has already said what he was establishing, what he was affirming, what he said was dependable and steadfast in the first sentence, which are his requirements to participate in the covenant and the requirements associated with salvation.
You know, the difference between trust and alliance and faith is something like this. If I go to get on a jet plane and I see a pilot and he's got captain's bars on his shoulders and he gets in a plane, I trust that this man's been trained to fly a plane.
Right.
Faith would be...
And you're going to rely on his ability to fly it.
Whoever gets to the pilot's position first gets to drive. Now, that would be faith. You know.
Here's
a giant difference between the two things. And
faith is a leap into the...
To buy into this concept of faith, which is what? It's depending on what's completely unknown.
Right.
That's all it is.
In the face of knowing, when you can know, there is no room for faith. When you cannot know, faith is the only alternative. So faith is the antithesis of knowing. Belief is the antithesis of understanding. Right. And so when we return to Shattering Myths, and we'll only have a few minutes to do this, and we'll pick up this story, and I hope you can join us tomorrow, because we'll continue with this story. But after the break, I'm going to share with you Paul's two corruptions of this testimony, one in Galatians 3:11, the other in Romans 1:17, and then we're going to share what God said next, which is to identify Shaul by name. Return in a moment. Hello, welcome back to Shattering Myths. In the time we have remaining, we're going to share Shaul's two misappropriated uses of Habakkuk 2, the prophecy from Yahweh that specifically condemns Paul. We'll continue with this story in our program tomorrow. This from Galatians 3:11. This is now Paul's first assault on the Torah. He says, but because with regard to the Torah, now, of course, but with regard to, even Yahweh used the term, but with regard to all of this, but with regard to the Torah, absolutely no one is vindicated or justified. So Paul has laid down the gauntlet. With the Torah,
I trashed the Torah, right?
Right. No, you can. The Torah cannot save. By God, and this becomes evident, and this is the use of circular reasoning, this becomes evident that the Torah cannot save because, then he cites, those who are vindicated, justified, and righteous out of faith will live. So, if it were true that out of faith the justified will live, if that were true, it is not. If that's what God actually said, and it's not, but if it were, talk about circular reasoning, it still would not prove the point. It's like me saying that the most popular color in bicycles is red, and a black bicycle will get you killed.
One doesn't die in with the other.
That's correct. They aren't. One doesn't follow the other. It's a logical fallacy. Now, in his later letter to the Romans, which is built off his letter to the Galatians, Paul writes, this is 1:17. For in it, the righteousness of God is revealed from belief to belief, from faith to faith. So in other words, from the faith of Abraham to now the faith in Paul's gospel of grace, as it has been written, but the righteous shall live by belief. Okay, so Paul now is trying to change everything. He's trying to change everything God said. Forget about all the requirements. Forget about the Torah. The Torah can't save. God's requirements can't save. God has now authorized me to tell you that has all been annulled, and now all you have to do is believe. And I'm taking God's testimony out of context to make that point. What does God say next? You know, this is context, context, context. What does God say next relative to the statement that Paul has misappropriated out of context? Moreover, because the intoxicating spirit of the man of deceptive infidelity and treacherous betrayal is a high-minded moral failure. Here's Paul using circular reasoning. It's exactly the same thing as, you know, black bicycles kill. The most popular color of bicycle is red. That was his point there. They don't flow from one another. That is deceptuous infidelity, treacherous betrayal of a high-minded moral failure. It says, because of the intoxicating spirit of the man, singular, of deceptive infidelity and treacherous betrayal, is a high-minded moral failure, is arrogant and meritless in his presumptions. He will not rest, he will not find peace nor satisfaction, whomever is open to the broad path associated with Shaul, the man's name. Shaul. Shaul is Paul. Shaul is Paul. That's his name. And it's what is the broadest, most popular way ever in human history? Christianity. More people have succumbed to Paul's religion than any in human history. And so God is saying the broad way that is associated with Paul, you will not find any satisfaction. You will not find contentment because his is an intoxicating spirit. He is a man of deceptive infidelity and treacherous betrayal. He's a high-minded moral failure. This man named Shaul, as is his broad path, the most popular religion ever, Christianity. And those who ascribe to it will find no satisfaction. What does God say next about Shaul? Paul, this man of Christianity that your theologian was praising. He and his soul are like the plague of death. And so those who are brought together by him, those who receive him, will never be satisfied. They will never find contentment. They will never find fulfillment. And indeed, that's the case. Not one of them. God even says, most every Gentile will gather together unto him, all of the people, from different races and places. He's speaking directly of Shaul, the founder of the Christian religion, Paul, condemning him, calling his words the plague of death. We'll return to Shattering Myths at this time tomorrow.
Hey, everybody, Jason Lewis here with another great idea from JasonLewisTeam.com. Now, how would you like an energy drink that's actually good for you? That's right, one that not only gives you an afternoon...